Hello, and welcome to the Mail Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Retall.
In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 comics sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top 300 comic book sales through Diamond to retailers for June 2011. We're getting a little bit of a late start. I'm recording this because the numbers started trickling out while I was driving out to Comic-Con, so I was away from my main machine. It took a little bit due to the post-con confusion and whatnot just around the industry for me to get some of the additional data I needed to kind of unlock the list. So we're probably going to be coming back with the July numbers pretty quick, another week or two probably. But June, interesting month. Once again, as is often the case of the breakdown of the top 300, Marvel came out on top. They had 47.13% of the units, 50.18% of the dollars. So what that means is over half the dollars for the top 300 at retail went to Marvel. Now, realistically, once you factor in the differing discounts, differing retailers getting stuff, as to who actually made the most, you know, it's not necessarily going to have broken down the way it does by retail dollars because of the discounting structure. Also, Marvel and DC are brokered by Diamond, so that works a little differently than how it does for the other publishers. But DC had the second largest part of the breakdown. They had 36.16% of the units, 32.31% of the dollars, so again, noticeable difference there. Marvel had 100 items on the list, 4 were reorder. DC only had 87 items, only one of which were reorder. And at San Diego, I was able to sit down for a while with John Rood, Executive Vice President of Sales, Marketing, and Business Development for DC Comics, and Bob Wayne, Senior VP of, I think it's sales, it could be marketing, I get his title confused. Anyways, basically, two of the head guys there about all of this, and one of the things they were really kind of stressing with me is they're not out for market share. They're not out for winning this breakdown every month. Because, and they were very blunt about this, John Rood actually said, if they were, they wouldn't be doing 52 new titles, they'd be doing like 104 or something. You know, so when we look at these breakdowns every month, and Chris and I talked about this on the trade episode too, and we'll talk about it now, Bob, I think it's good to see reflectively kind of within the month how things stack up, who had the most stuff come out, who had the most sales, whatever. But also, one of the things we never do, and I do this intentionally, we don't do this, is compare the percentage breakdown this month to last month. And part of the reason for that is while Marvel had 50% of the dollars at retail price coming in this month, and they may have had less last month or more last month, actually, I can probably go check that real quick. What it comes down to is the size of the pie changes every month. I mean, they had 50.18% this month. They had 51.81% last month. Sometimes that does reflect an increase. Sometimes that does not. A matter of fact, in April, Marvel had 51.82% of the dollars for the top 300 and made roughly about $20,000 more than they made this month. So it's a question of, is that percentage more, is that less? In February, though, they made 50.96% of the dollars, which is more than this month, yet they made about $85,000 less. So looking at the, is their market share up or down? Don't do that. It gives, it's not a valid metric. It's really just comparatively who's pumping out more stuff, who's getting more unit sales, who's getting more dollar sales, and even the dollar sales is a factor more of the average price than, you know, And again, easy to skew. DC, again, kind of intentionally losing out on that metric by holding the line at 299, whereas Marvel has a lot more 399 cover price books, and therefore that's why their percentage by dollars for the top 300 usually is beneficial for them.
It'd be interesting to, I mean, I know we can't do this because we just don't have the information, nor will we ever. But, you know, just like, what does it really cost to produce these 100-and-some-odd comics? I mean, it's like, you know, we kind of roughly know what Marvel's getting out of that $10 million or so dollars, right? That they're,
well, even that we're not certain.
I know. I mean, roughly. I said, you know, we don't know exactly. You kind of got like some idea, you know, it's that, you know, it's in the ballpark, but how close it is, who knows? But, you know, how much rate, we know they have all these editors and, you know, the creators themselves, you know, and Bendis, I'm sure, has, you know, some massive, any of these guys who are architects, but probably Bendis sitting on the top of the giant pile, you know, has some real sweetheart deal where, you know, he's making more than, you know, other people, and then these other architects are making more than people who aren't architects, and, you know, this artist is making more than that artist. But, you know, when you add all it all up, it costs them a decent amount of money to put out all of these books, you know, so they're making a lot of money, but they're spending a lot of money too. And when it comes right down to it, you know, I think Marvel's profitable as an entity, but realistically, for Marvel, I don't think the profit is really the driving factor, because it's an IP engine for Marvel / Disney to be using this stuff that they create to make TV shows and cartoons and, well, you know, little tchotchkes that they sell people in stores and all this other kinds of stuff.
I can't speak to that specifically for Marvel, but I can for DC, again, having just spoken with those guys at Comic-Con. And the way John Rood, and if you guys haven't listened to the Mayo report I did with DC Comics and stuff during Con, please go back and listen to that. It was, I thought, a really interesting conversation. But John Rood, and I'm pretty sure Bob Wayne later repeated the phrasing in terms of what is their mandate, what is their charge, and that is, DC Entertainment is charged with the kind of the generation and maintaining of intellectual properties that can then be leveraged across the other branches of Warner Brothers, which is exactly what you're saying there with presumably Marvel's in the same boat of DC Comics is a brand of DC Entertainment. DC Entertainment is not a comic book publisher. They publish comics as a way to create, maintain, and evolve intellectual properties that then may be profitable there, may not be, who knows, but one of the factors is not just how do their comics sell, but also how do their trades sell. And John Rube was very clear that with this new 52 we're getting in September, until those trades come out in May of next year, we're not really going to have the full picture. And even then, you may have stuff that doesn't do well, but for whatever reason, they feel they can leverage it really well as merchandise, as a TV show, as a cartoon, as a video game, as some web thing, or some other branch of the Warner empire can really take that property and run with it.
Yeah, I mean, I went to the Marvel TV panel at San Diego, and Jeff Loeb is, I guess, Marvel's executive VP or something in charge of television.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're talking about the new Spider-Man cartoon, they're talking about the new Hulk cartoon, they're talking about live-action shows for Cloak and Dagger, Mockingbird. There's an Alias one, which they can't call Alias because that Jennifer Garner series, but they're calling it, like, I don't know, something Jessica Jones something, but it's going to have Jessica Jones and Luke Cage and Carol Danvers in it, you know, and they just went through a whole bunch of properties that seemed very interesting, and any one of these, you know, they're not going to all be successful, right? I mean, generally nothing is, but any popular TV show is going to make money on the order that eclipses, you know, any of these comic books.
Even if it doesn't make money, it'll at least get it out to a wider audience. For every Birds of Prey that lasted 13 episodes, sooner or later you're going to have, and maybe not on a 1-to-1 ratio, of course, a Smallville that lasts 10 years. Smallville not only got the whole Superman Clark Kent thing out there, they were able to use it to actually get a live action Blue Beetle and Booster Gold episode. They had Green Lantern or Green Arrow as a regular character. They had Green Lantern and the rest of the JSA there for an episode or two. They had Hawkman as a recurring a time or two. Again, Black Canary, some of these others. So they're able to leverage one successful TV show across a lot of different properties and kind of get some awareness out there. And I really think that for our age group, a lot of what got us into comics was the fact that we'd wake up on Saturday morning, we'd see the Super Friends, we'd see the Batman Hour or whatever, we'd see, you know, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, all those kinds of shows. We were aware of these characters, we liked these characters. Oh, look, there's a comic book of a character I know and like, I'll go buy that. Whereas we don't really have that as much today.
Well, the interesting thing was, and it was even the same all the way back into the 60s and 70s, you know, there was, you know, the Spider-Man cartoon show that I used to watch, and there were some other Marvel shows and some DC shows. But, you know, you would see the cartoon, but then pretty much anywhere that you went, there was a spinner rack of comics, and it was like, oh, there's a comic too. And you had that opportunity. What we now have the opportunity for with digital comics is, you know, we went through a long period of time with the direct market where even though there have been a number of very successful Spider-Man cartoon shows and Batman and Justice League and Brave and the Bold, you know, there's been a lot of cartoon shows that have been very, very well received and have run for several years and, you know, all kinds of kids watch them. But those kids and their parents are not going into a comic book shop. Therefore, they do not see the comic books and they don't say, oh, I can buy this comic book.
I'll take it a step further. Yeah. Not only, I mean, even if they get into a comic shop, how many comic shops have those in a prominent display? And how many comic stores would you just stumble across that Young Justice comic book, that Brave and the Bold comic, or the kids' Marvel Heroes stuff? Usually that's segregated off and something where if you ask, they can point you to it, but not
if,
something
if
you're...
If the store even, because you know, we can look at this list at how those titles tend to sell in the direct market.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, do they even have copies of it? Whereas with digital, it's available. You know, you know, somebody likes it, you point them to, here you go. And, you know, maybe that's going to really help.
I think digital has the definite potential of helping because it's one of those things where if at 2 in the morning you decide, I want to go read this, that, or the other, you don't need to write it down. Remember to go to the store the next day if you can find a store. See if they have it. If they have it, buy it, get it, and read it. By then the mood is lost. You just pull out, you know, either walk to your computer or go to your iPad or Google Pad or whatever device of your choosing. You go online, you grab it then, you read it then, you're done. I mean, the instant gratification aspect, I think, is advantageous. Now, one of the things with digital I find very interesting is I went to the ICV2 conference before San Diego Comic-Con, and it's more, you know, insider-type stuff of here's how things are selling, here are the trends we're seeing. Milton Greep does a great job on that, puts a lot of work into that, had quite a few panels. I mean, it was like a four-hour thing, but man, it was a packed 4 hours and very tightly, you know, moving forward and tightly packed and stuff and incredibly well-organized. I was very impressed with that. But a lot of it was on digital, the up-and-coming, how is this panning out? And they had a couple of panels, one of which had one of the big guys from IDW. It was not Chris Ryle. I forget his name. I forgot it when I was recording with Chris and didn't think to look it up in the meanwhile, which I apologize for again. Anyways, IDW has been very big on the digital from early on. They did the Star Trek Countdown comic, which tied into the movie very effectively as a digital thing. They've been doing a lot of the Transformers stuff, you know, with the current movies and whatnot, with the comics and tying in. So they've been very aggressive on the digital. And somebody asked, well, okay, how's that working for you? I mean, what percentage of your income is that totaling up to? Now, what would you guess for that?
Oh, gee, I don't even know how to hazard a guess on that. I mean,
the answer, 3%.
Jeez, that's very poor.
Well, it's not poor. It's early.
Yeah, but I mean, it's, you know, it's.
But compared to the amount of hype, the amount of discussion.
Yeah, you hear about it so much, you know, and it's like, I knew it was a low number, but I didn't know at the front of my mind exactly what it was, you know. The other thing that's going to be very interesting is you have access to some relatively objective sales data on the physical comics because Diamond puts that information out, right?
Yes.
For digital books, you know, that are going to be going through a variety of these mechanisms, there's not any central place that you'll be able to get any number except from the publishers themselves, and they have zero reason to ever make that public.
Well, it comes yes and no. There are a couple, like Comixology, where the way they have written their contracts with the publisher precludes them from giving out that information to me or anyone. Okay, so that was a either intentional business choice or an unfortunate business reality that came about with them. However, there's places like Panelfly, there's places like the Iverse stuff where, you know, I may be able to get some inroads there. Now, because we're in a realm where there are multiple publishers digitally for these, our creators of these apps, I'm not even sure some of the right terminology, to be honest. But there's also the iTunes store. There are multiple distribution channels, I guess is the best way to put it. I mean, we were in this boat at one point with the comic books where you had the Diamond charts, you had the Capital City charts, and neither one was a complete picture of the direct market, much less the big picture. So we're going to be in that boat for quite some time, I think, if not permanently, digitally. Now, I may be able to get some inroads, be it with Iverse, be it with Panelfly, whoever, to get some objective-ish sales stuff. Now, it may just be, here's a, you know, this sold twice as much as this, this sold half as much as that kind of a thing, but it would at least give relative rankings within the month. Now, whether that would be something I could compare across months or not, don't know. But just knowing how things did relative to each other, and not a ranked list, but an indexed list, I think would be good, and I've tried to convince some of these people, having a third party objectively able to look at this and do some analysis and report on it, I think gives their numbers a bit more, or their sales a bit more credibility. Because otherwise, you're right, it's just PR releases saying, oh, it sold great! And again, we've gotten some of that stuff out of...
What does that mean? You know, because...
Well,
everything's always the greatest, you know, when you hear a marketing person talking about it. That's their job.
I have no doubt over the years IDW sent out press releases saying how great their digital stuff has done. And it has done very well. Then you counter that with it's 3% of their income. Now, that's not to say they're doing bad. That's not to say their press releases are wrong or even misleading. It's a matter of without that objective grounding kind of number of that 3%, you don't have the full perspective. And it would be very interesting to know how things, what the sales trends are, particularly with the DC stuff. I'm going to be very interested if I can hunt that down, and I probably won't be able to, unless there's somebody who's like understands the Apple iTunes API and can somehow ferret that information out. If so, please contact me. I would love to have some sort of objective information on digital sales.
Well, I mean, it's similar with all the press releases about, you know, this comic sold out, that comic sold out. And it's like, well, you know, how meaningful is that?
Yeah, how big was the print run? And you're printing to order, it should sell out, damn it.
I mean, any book can become a sellout. Any book. You can sell 1,000 copies. You could sell 10 copies and make it a sellout if you only printed 10 copies.
Or only printed 9, but yeah.
Yeah.
But come really August 31st, sellouts from DC for their DC Comics brand, that line of comics, are meaningless.
Right, because
it basically
digital.
Becomes a negative reflection on the people who ordered, the people who set the print run, etc., of unable to really gauge the demand. Not to say that that's an easy thing to do or that they should able to be get it right every time.
When I worked for the magazine and book distributor years ago, and I was doing the software system for them, and I used to go out and, you know, we actively tried, because this wasn't, you know, the stores would not order magazines. We would put magazines mm-hmm. on the rack. And part of the software I was writing was to analyze sales trends to make sure you never had bare wire
yep.
in a store. Because if you came to rotate the magazines out and there was bare wire, it means you potentially lost sales.
Exactly.
You know, the ideal situation was there was one copy sitting on the wire when you came to put the next issue out.
To my mind, if I were running a comic book store, my ideal situation, if I were not doing back issues, which maybe I would, maybe I wouldn't, but if I were not, would be that as I was getting ready to pull that single copy out, that somebody was saying, oh, I want to buy that. I mean, literally, right before I would go pull it. So the bare wire would be right as I'm ready to go fill that with the next issue.
Right. And the big difference is that, you know, the returnable versus the non-returnable model. I mean, when you make a non-returnable model, it's just any unsold copy is money out, potential money out of the retailer's pocket, and it's causing them to be one step closer to bankruptcy, potentially, you know, well, if they've got these unsold copies that they can't turn around as back issues. And it's almost the direct market model is not in sync with increasing sales.
It's interesting because this is another area where I'm just really kind of blown away by some of the moves DC is making right now. Because for the stuff coming out in September, and really that's going to be a fascinating month to be talking about the numbers on, they are making a lot of these items, particularly the more risky ones, I think, returnable. They're putting incentives on the other ones. They're doing what they can to mitigate the risk for the retailers. Now, in addition to that, the thing they're doing for brick-and-mortar retailers that I really did not understand, and I think a lot of people didn't understand until that ICV2 panel where Bob Wayne was on one of these about digital comics, and they were talking about the ability of retailers to sell a digital copy to a reader at the store, and what was happening is the retailer gets 30% of the income. Okay, that's not a big deal. 15% they would normally get or whatever, but Bob Wayne made a point of having, because I think it was one of the guys from Diamond explaining this, he made a point of clarifying, okay, so 15% is this. Where is that other 15% coming from? I thought you said 30. And he's like, well, yes, that's coming from DC. And Bob Wayne being, he can be a little flip at times, but really, you know, he was very effective in how he communicated this. And he's like, so let me get this clear. DC is taking 15% of the cover price out of their own pocket and giving it to the retailer, so they would be making as much on that as they would a print copy or whatever kind of a thing. In other words, DC on the print side with this new relaunch is going out of their way to mitigate the risk. On the digital side, they're going way out of their way to make sure that retailers aren't getting cut out of that revenue stream if they want to take part in it. So this is something, particularly as we're seeing the numbers dwindle in a lot of respects, DC has made move after move after move for the betterment of the readers, the retailers, and the industry at their own cost. I mean, this whole rollback to $2.99, I don't know if they were really hoping it was going to raise sales or not. I think they were hoping it would at least mitigate the decline of sales. But while that bought them some goodwill, as somebody phrased it to me in San Diego, that was some very expensive goodwill to go purchase. Perhaps too expensive. And, you know, there's a lot of validity to that vantage point. You know, DC is shaking things up. They're trying not to do business as usual. It's clear they are in the mindset of being an intellectual property provider for the rest of their corporate empire, which is fine and good. They're still very invested emotionally, fiscally, and business-wise in the print comics and digital comics realm. One of the things we talked about when I was there with John and Bob of DC versus us, John and Bob, was how they were very clear, if all of the digital stuff does is take print readers and move them to digital, that's bad, they have failed, they are unhappy. They want that to be additive and to work in the manner of, again, it's 2 in the morning, somebody who wouldn't read comics read something about the Justice League and said, oh, there's that Justice League number one, let me go read it now. I mean, to get new readers, not just to move existing ones around on the chessboard. So it was...
This whole buying digital comics in the comic store, I must admit I'm a little hazy on why somebody would buy a digital comic at a physical location. I'm not wrapping my head around that, unless it's like you're getting some kind of incentive for doing it.
Well, to me, the main selling point, and I think the way they're positioning it mainly, is not you go to the store to buy something you could just get off your iPad to begin with. It's you buy for an additional 99 cents or whatever a digital copy of the comic you have in your hand and are buying.
Well, they did that with Justice League.
Yes.
Right? But not with any of the other 52 books.
I'm thinking that as part of the Diamond Digital stuff, and I'll admit, not having a suitable device for reading these things on at the moment, I haven't really dived too deep into this area. But I think that was more the mindset, and basically Diamond trying to get a piece of that digital pie, which again just adds another middleman to take a slice out between the creator and the reader.
I could see like paying an extra 99 cents to get a digital copy in addition to your regular copy, maybe. But I mean, just like buying the regular $2.99 comic book digital from a comic shop.
I don't think that's the main use case. Yeah. I don't think that's the expected result. And I can see buying a digital copy for a fee above what I'm paying for the print. 99 cents seems a little much for something I've physically got in my hand.
I mean, I could maybe see, you know, if you're a store and you've got loyal customers and, you know, you have a website for your store, you know, you can have your customers go buy their digital comics through a portal that's hosted on the website for your store.
And that's also what they're going for,
which,
yeah.
You know, it's like, hey, you know, no skin off my nose. If I was going to buy digital comics anyway, instead of just buying them from some random place on the internet, I may as well buy them from a store that I know and trust and have a relationship with, you know, and
yeah.
That, you know, why not?
I think it's as much a matter of DC Diamond, Iverse, Panelfly, Comixology and stuff, trying to find a business model that works both digitally and one that they can leverage the, again, the customer relationships the stores have, etc., and trying to explicitly not turn their back on the brick-and-mortar stores that have really built up the current state of the comic industry. So it's, I don't say making the best of a bad situation, but really trying to find the best in an unknown situation. Because I really think, again, with that 3% number as a reference point, and that's one that 3% will grow over time, just as it used to be 1% or whatever. Digital comics are not, I mean, they're here, but they're not a major force. It's just like back when trades, they only listed the top 10 because really trades weren't that big of a factor sales-wise. Now they are, we get the top 300. Digital, I think, is that third kind of venue for the comic format. And it'll be interesting to see when that really comes into full swing, when that becomes something they can justify creating new content for. Will they also do it in print? I mean, we're in a very much a formative stage here. But for all the talk of digital and you know how big of a deal it is, and really that's been going on for a couple of years now. I mean, the last two San Diego Comic-Con podcasting panels, the majority of the discussion's been around digital. You know, and that's great, that's fine, I guess. But for my money, for my perspective, it's still on the horizon in terms of being a major revenue stream. It's not here and, oh my God, that's where all the money is.
Right.
But, you know, we'll see how that goes.
You made me smile just a minute or so ago, though, when you said the comic shops that have helped build the industry or something to that effect. You remember the panel at San Diego, is the comic book doomed? Remember what Mark Waid said? It was like, oh yeah, you know, we've taken a medium that sold millions of copies and turned it into a niche market of a niche market or something. Yeah, yeah.
We took a mass media and turned it into a niche market.
Yeah.
It was essentially his phrase. And, I mean, I agree with his point there, but he used to be, you know, chief creative officer at Boom. He's worked at the majority of the big companies out there, DC, Marvel, you know, Boom, etc. Trying to think what he did maybe for Dark Horse or for Image and stuff. But the point is, he's been in the industry for quite some time, and for him to take the stand, there's not enough blame to go around for the publishers. I mean, on the one hand, I don't completely disagree with that, because, I mean, there have been some really poor decisions. Marvel's current move of milking every, you know, if one Hulk title sells good, let's do another five. If, you know, one Avengers title does good, let's do another five. DC having 13 Batman, Gotham City-type titles. Really, I mean, the risk they're taking with the relaunch, I mean, there are a lot of decisions that sometimes pan out, sometimes don't, but it's not the fault of the publishers entirely. You gotta wonder, I mean, if the creators were telling stories that clicked better with the readers, if there would be reader retention from issue to issue. Because right now, there is not. You know, I've got to think that things at the retail level are broken, just like you were saying that the direct sales, the non-returnability is not conducive to growing sales. I think that's a very valid point. So I think there are things that are broken at so many different levels that to try to lump the blame all on the publishers.
I'm not saying that it's all on the publishers. I'm just saying, you know, in fact, I'm saying...
Wade
did, but I'm just saying it's a lot of it is equally shared with the current distribution model that took comics away from being available to many more people and putting them in a place that you had to go find.
But a flip side perspective on that is they were getting kicked out of the 7-Elevens and, you know, those stores or whatnot because they weren't profitable per square foot. So the fact the comic store and the direct market came about as a way to, as an alternate venue to make comics remain viable could be seen as a good thing. I mean, certainly it had ramifications, and the lack of that entry ramp via the spinner rack is a huge problem, and one that's a generational one that's been coming to roost for many years now. But it's not like a decision was made to necessarily thumb their nose up at a retail outlet that was saying, please let us have more. It's like, oh, we're not going to go there. We're above you, beneath you, you know, whatever. It was more a matter of, again, the grocery stores, the 7-Elevens, those stores. It ceased to be viable. And the irony is, it was because of the low price point at the time. And this was back when they were 35 cents, 40 cents, 50 cents. You know, now that they're up to the $2.99, $3.99, they might be very profitable for a store. I don't know.
Only if people were buying them. And, you know, that's the...
But if they were available, might people buy them? If they were single-issue installments that you got, you know, a return on that investment for that single issue, would they buy them? I mean, it's such a combination of so many factors. It's, you know, it's surprising. And the title of that panel was Are Comics Doomed? And, you know, I mean, I was sitting in there too. Wade had a lot of very good points. I think Amanda Emmert from Comics Pro had a lot of very valid points. I think she was very optimistic about it. But think about that for a second. You've got a creator making his living off comics, a retailer making her living off selling comics and stuff. Mark Waid, the creator, has a very, yep, it's doomed, it's dead, dying, and maybe it needs to.
Well, being clear, though, comics is an art form. I don't think anybody was saying comics are going to go away.
As an industry, as a viable business. That's fair clarification.
As, like, you know, hundreds of titles a month getting blasted out, you know, in a way, is that sustainable? And, you know, to some extent, you know, but whatever form, Marvel and DC, you know, since they are IP engines for much larger corporations, there's going to be something. You know, they're not going away.
But for somebody like Mark Waid, who makes his livelihood writing comics as a business, you know, living career, etc., for him to say the business of comics is currently doomed, it's like, well, why the hell doesn't he go write TV or something? You know, whereas Amanda from Comics Pro, you know, had a much more upbeat, I think a little overly so at times, but I spent some time talking with her afterwards and got some clarification on some of her insight and stuff, and she was pretty open that, yeah, I mean, things may not be great, but then you've got something like this new relaunch from DC that's getting a lot of mainstream press. There's a lot of energy, excitement, momentum behind it. That is an opportunity for comic stores, for the industry. So I think the perspective is you have two people, Mark and Amanda, who've jumped out of a plane. Mark thinks he doesn't have a parachute and therefore is doomed. Amanda thinks she's got a parachute. Hell, she may even have a jetpack. So she doesn't think the industry is doomed. It's a matter of perspective. And I think both perspectives have a lot of factual evidence behind them, a lot of emotion and relevance behind them. I think both have valid points in various areas. But since both are making their money in this industry, I think the smarter attitude is Amanda's, who's looking for the how can we make it better, versus Mark's, who at one point flat out said, maybe the industry needs to crumble so we can rebuild something to replace it. You know, and I've got a lot of respect for Mark Waid, both as a writer, as an editor, as chief creative officer at Boom, as a comic industry professional, as a comic historian. I think he's a very smart guy, and he's one of those that I think if there is a way to turn things around in the industry, he's going to be one of the people near the forefront of that, or thinking, damn, I should have thought of it, you know?
Well, so, to be fair to Mark, I also think he was, to some extent, just being devil's advocate.
Oh, totally.
Some of this stuff. It's not like he was, you know, gnashing his teeth and wailing about Doom and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
He was a little over the top at times, particularly with the...
For effect, though, right? I think.
Definitely for effect, but the bottom line is he did say what he said. You know, the whole there's not enough blame to go around for the publishers thing is a little harsh. Now, does it need to be said so people will wake up? Yeah, maybe. And I think Waid is moving more towards the digital because he can't figure out how to make the print viable. And I can't fault him for that. I can't disagree with that. I question if the print is continuing to be viable. And I think he and Amanda had a brief discussion afterwards where, you know, he was, I think, trying to get some insight from her where she thought it was more viable than he did, because he flat out said at one point, you know, when she came back with here's how much it costs to print a comic and it was lower than his figure by a significant amount, like 30%, he's like, well, you know, then maybe I'm wrong and I need to rethink everything. And what I like about Mark Waid and what I really respect is when new information becomes available, he absorbs it, he takes it, and he reformulates his opinion. He's not kind of locked into any one mindset. I think he would love for comics, and he said it a number of times on that panel, nobody wants comics to be doomed. Comics are in a bad state and not getting better. It's a question of doomed implies there is no hope. I think there is hope. Whether it's likely or not's the question. But it's something that I think everybody, you know, readers, retailers, creators, need to take a serious look at how things are doing, what's working and why, and is that really a good thing?
Well, I think it's a lot like the U.S. economy. I mean, you know, you need a certain amount of shakeup and things to get to a certain bad point before actual change and reform is going to make sense, you know, or at least be able to be made because of various factors that are in play. Well, you know, I think it's the same thing. I think what he was implying there was, hey, you know, there's a lot of challenges that are happening right now. And, you know, realistically, until things get bad enough to, like, Shane, that's why I think when he's saying, you know, it needs to crumble before you can rebuild it. It's not crumble to the point of it being completely gone, but, you know, there needs to be a shakeup. And I think there's already been enough of a downturn in things that, you know, I think, you know, look at what DC's doing. I would pretty much count what DC's doing right now as an example of, you know, things got to a certain point that caused DC to do what they're doing, you know, to try to rebuild, you know, the DC books that had they not had to, would this have, you know, would they have relaunched the entire line?
No, if they didn't have to, they would not have. If things are going well, you continue the status quo. When the status quo is not working, that's when you pull out all the stops and do unprecedented things, again, like the DC relaunch. Now, actually talking about the top 300 for a little bit, since we've been talking a lot of, you know, big picture type stuff, which I think is great, top of the list this time around is Ultimate Comics Spider-Man 160. It sold 159,355 estimated units. That's triple, over triple, what the previous issue had sold. And this, of course, was when they killed off the ultimate Peter Parker Spider-Man.
Death Cells.
Death Cells, but, you know, how many lead characters of a universe can you kill off every quarter? Now, granted, I think Marvel's trying to push the envelope on that, it seems like.
Well, they brought back the polybag, too. So, you know, your hardcore collectors, whenever there's a polybag, they're going to buy a copy to open and a copy to save.
Yeah. And I think they had alternate covers, a spoiler cover. I mean, they pulled out all the stops, marketing stops on this. It's hit the mainstream press, etc. I mean, they've gone back to the mainstream press with who the new Ultimate Spider-Man is. I mean, this is marketing-induced sales, particularly because if people were interested in this character and how he died, they would have been following the entire storyline. You know, and that's just the way things are, not necessarily good or bad. But the next, that was the only one to break 100,000, and it did it by a huge margin, no question. Fear Itself number 3 came in at rank 2 with 95,621 estimated units. That's off by about 6% from total sales of the previous issue, of which there were, I believe, some reorder on it this month. Let me go validate that I'm not speaking. Yeah, it sold another 5,374 units of reorder for issue number 2, which makes issue number 2 have cracked the 100,000 mark belatedly. But better than the never. Flashpoint number 2, rank number 3, 87,505 estimated units. That's down about 8.7% from the first issue, which really for a second issue drop is pretty minor. It's about a third of little over a third of the average, though, which is about 21% or so, last I looked. So we've got a couple of things that sold, again, really well for that Ultimate Comics Spider-Man one-shot deal. That's not continual. You know, that's here and gone. Fear Itself Flashpoint still doing pretty well for these events, though. But the highest selling ongoing issue or ongoing series is Avengers 14 at 64,057 estimated units. That's down a little under 6% from the previous sales. You know, we're getting to the point where the ongoing that's also the only other thing that did over 59,000 units. So we're getting to the point where these ongoing things, including titles that had started very high, such as Avengers, FF, etc., not doing so well.
Well, I mean, and that's, you know, Avengers is like the backbone franchise.
Yep.
For Marvel. And I almost wonder, by having the events and all this stuff that Marvel has, are they driving readers to say, you know what, I'm just going to read the event, and I don't even need to read the monthly. If I want to see my Marvel superheroes, I'll just get Fear Itself.
And, let's talk about that for a second, because I highlighted a couple of groups of titles. If you filter the list in column AD to where I've got the X for the check mark, and then filter it down to just Marvel, what you should get is, obviously, the Ultimate Comics Spider-Man, Fear Itself, Avengers, but then the other half dozen or so-ish Fear Itself titles. Now, Fear Itself, again, sold 95,621. The highest Fear Itself miniseries or one-shot on the list this time around, unless I missed one, and I might have, was the Fear Itself Spider-Man number 2 at 30,238. That is under a third of what Fear Itself sold. You go down to Fear Itself Youth and Revolt down there at the bottom of this list, and again, unless I missed one, because there's so many of these things, 20,376 units. So less than a quarter.
And, I mean, you get back to when we were talking about Spider Island on the recent Weekly Comic Spotlight. You know, it's just like, I did the same thing with Fear Itself. I mean, the only Fear Itself, well, I got Spider-Man and Youth in Revolt, and then I dropped Youth in Revolt after the first issue. I kept on getting Spider-Man more from liking Spider-Man than anything else, which, you know, it's like I probably could have done without it. And, you know, that's the kind of thing. A lot of people, you know, they see Marvel just cranking out these, look at that, 2, 4, 6, 7 Fear Itself tie-ins.
That's not even counting all of the ones with the Fear Itself banner on them.
Right.
I've got a short box of comics here that I'm behind on from the last month, And I have, at the moment, anything that's got the Fear Itself banner, I'm just saying, well, let me get to the other stuff first. And I'll read Fear Itself in one big go or something. And there's a ton of them. So I excluded those for this comparison. But for these couple of titles that are very clearly existing only because of Fear Itself, the average sales are about 25% of the sales of that third issue of Fear Itself. So if only a quarter of the readers on average are interested in these other titles, are they worth continuing? I think in a future event, doing these sorts of things is a bad move. Now that's here at Marvel. Let's go look over at DC for a second. Because of course, you know, we've got there Flashpoint and all of its different titles. Now, the highest selling ongoing title for DC, just as a point of comparison, is Batman Incorporated number 7. That'll go on hiatus with the relaunch. It's got 56,108 estimated units. So again, that and Emerald Warriors of 53,927 estimated units for its 11th issue kind of sets the bar for again, what's the top of the list for a DC ongoing title. Flashpoint, though, these crossovers I found to be really, really interesting. Flashpoint number 2, 87,505 estimated units, as we talked about. Highest selling of these Flashpoint colon whatevers, Batman Knights of Vengeance number 1, and frankly, it's not even the real Batman, 45,129 units. That's about 52% of the sales of Flashpoint. Well, that's actually not bad. Again, over half the readers are interested in stuff. It's actually about 51.6, we'll say. I'll go to a decimal point there just for additional clarity. But then you get to the bottom of the list, which unsurprisingly is Flashpoint, the Canterbury Cricket. Poor solicitation, unknown character, unknown story. The fact this sold 22,948 units really, I think, is a credit to, I'm going to go with the creative team. Because I don't know what else people would have bought it on other than the fact it was a Flashpoint thing.
Yeah, I mean, all the one-shots are down there, right? You know, you got Green Arrow, Grotta War, Canterbury Cricket, you know, as opposed to the three-issue series. There was a Was there a fourth one-shot that's not on this list?
Reverse Flash, and it did 32,554 units there. It ranked 50, which is about 37.2%. Okay. But that is
that's
all
more
20.
Of a known character and following off of some storylines in Flash.
But that Canterbury Cricket sold 26.2% of Flashpoint number 2 sales, so not bad. But what really surprised me in I would have expected this to bump up a bit more is that Booster Gold 45. 26,183 estimated units. That's up about 12% from the previous issue, which was also a Flashpoint tie-in. But that is the second lowest Flashpoint-related thing and the only non-Flashpoint-titled thing tying into Flashpoint, with Canterbury Cricket being the only one doing worse. So the only ongoing title tying into this, essentially, out of all this, while it did better than it usually did, tanked in comparison to everything else. You know,
for people who don't read previews and just like wander into the stores, I mean, I'm trying to think of what the trade dress on Booster.
They have the Flashpoint logo.
Has the Flashpoint logo?
Yeah, it looks just as tied in as the others, I believe.
Because that's actually been a really good story, but you know, again,
well, anyone wondering why
they don't care? You know?
Well, anyone wondering why Booster Gold is not a title in the 2.0 lineup for DC? This is a pretty good indication. Now, granted, he's going to be one of the lead characters in that Justice League International, but again, team book versus solo. So, I mean, these kind of scattered across the rankings between rank 23 and 105. Again, that high of that Batman Knights of Vengeance of the 45,000 plus, Canterbury Cricket a little under the 23,000 and stuff. So they kind of scattered as expected. Some of the ones showed up... Really, I don't think we're too surprising. The Batman one at the top, the two Green Lantern and the Hal Jordan one after that, then Project Superman, then Wonder Woman, with the one-shots being further down and stuff. I think it's interesting, but again, half the readers aren't interested in these. You know, half the readers of Flashpoint, I should say. So, is this worth you know, continuing with overall or not. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's a good indication to me, again, of the difference between people who go to comic shops to buy comics and the potential market that the DC relaunch is going to be addressing. And, you know, I said before, I mean, if they are counting on just comic shops, I think the relaunch will tank. You know, it's just there's so many people in comic shops that are trained to think a certain way about things and have certain buying patterns and all that, and getting it to a more expansive target audience, that will potentially be the game changer for them.
Well, I think what's going to happen with the relaunch is these are side series of an event. This is seen as an extravagance, I think, by a lot of readers. You know, the sales for the new Batman titles are not going to be based on, you know, Batman Night of Vengeance so much as how Batman, Batman Incorporated, Batman and Robin, you know, Detective Comics, how those have been selling. Now, in many cases, they're roughly the same as this, or worse. I mean, that Flashpoint Wonder Woman and the Furies sold about 6,000 more units than the two issues of Wonder Woman that came out this month in June. So I think what's going to happen is September is going to be a really, really strong month for DC, probably unprecedentedly strong month, with the first month of the 1 year later being the best comparison point. We're going to see probably some significant drops on the following month with the number twos, and then from there it's really going to be anyone's guess as to what has clicked, what has not. Back with issue 3, and particularly by the time we get down towards December and in January, when the newness is worn off and these things really need to stand on their own legs. You know, when people have seen how these titles either work for them or don't work for them, or whatever criteria they use, you know, and start basing their ordering decisions as readers, as retailers, on the actual material versus the anticipation of the material, which is where we're at now. Now, the irony is, with these three-issue miniseries for Flashpoint, it would usually take to the fourth before you would see any kind of an uptick due to the, wow, this is really good. So it could be that next month what we're going to see is, at the bottom of the list, a lot of reorder activity on some of these Flashpoint titles as people actually didn't order them but tried them out at the rack or whatever.
And I certainly did that with a lot. I would say most of them. And, you know, I'm glad that I did. Because, you know, I liked them. I think a lot of people didn't, though, you know, at the same time, you know.
Yeah, yeah. All right, what else do we have on here that looked interesting? Oh, the other thing that was kind of funny is rank 52 was Walking Dead 86 at 32,187 units. I find that funny because that's, like, right in the middle of the pack there for those Flashpoint titles and stuff. So, I mean, Kirkman's selling on par with a DC event secondary title. The difference is he's worked his way up to those sales, whereas, you know, you could argue DC has worked its way down on some of those. Brightest Day Aftermath, The Search number 1, came in at rank 16, 51,928 units. Again, that's kind of a not really an event, but not really not an event either. It's kind of weird. We don't have a lot of other than the Flashpoint ones, a lot of number ones. We had a couple of the Green Lantern movie prequels. They did okay at around the 30,000 mark, give or take. X-Men Prelude to Schism, not really setting the sales world on fire here.
I will say that I was in a comic shop last week, and, you know, there was a guy in there with his little kid who was maybe, let's say, 7 or 8, who was, you know, really urging his dad to buy him more of those Green Lantern movie tie-ins because he had seen and liked the movie. You know, it's like, oh, Dad, we don't have the Tomar Ray one yet, you know, so that was encouraging.
I've been enjoying those, actually. I've been reading all of them, and they're good stuff. And they seem to obviously be part of the movie tie-in, but
good,
not...
Good standalone where you pick it up and read it and it's...
Good standalone and conducive towards if you were to then shift to the main Green Lantern titles, it wouldn't be off-putting. Now, really, the top-selling one I think we have this time around is Hal Jordan at the 29,245. Then Kilowog, then Abinsur. Tamar Rhee was down at the 24,811, so I was probably a little high with that 30,000. So, really, 25,000.
Did Sinestro ever come out?
I believe it came out the previous month. Let me...
Because I know it was late. I had heard that it was like over a month late, and I don't remember, because I've seen copies of the other ones on the rack at the store. I don't recall ever seeing a Sinestro on a rack.
Give me a second. I will look through my previous shipping lists, because I would have gotten it. And we go back another few shipping lists. I am Hal Jordan... I'm not seeing it, but I thought I had read that. I didn't think that was the one that was late.
The Sinestro one definitely was the one that was late.
Okay. I am seeing all of the others. That one may not have come out yet, then. Maybe he was showing up in the Tomar Rae one, and that's what I'm thinking. Because I'm not seeing it in the last couple of lists that I've gotten from DCBS. So I don't think it's come out then. It's hard to keep track of all these things. And that's part of it when they do, you know, so many similar-ish ones. Obviously, they're going to collect all these into a trade paperback or whatever at some point. Probably, if they're smart, to coincide with when the DVD comes out. It just makes sense to do. Let's see. Jumping down towards the bottom of the list, we tend to do that every month. Rank 300 here is that Stan Lee Starborn number 7. 44,027 units. We go up two ranks. We've got Stan Lee's Traveler, number 8. That did 46,088 estimated units, or 48,688 units. And where Soldier Zero, topping the list for that universe at 4,855 estimated units. Those are down, let's see, Starborn's down almost 8.5%, Traveler almost 8%, and Soldier Zero close to 7%. And these are on issues 7, 8, and 9 respectively. Those kinds of drops, not a good sign at that stage. They should have leveled out a little bit more by now.
And as we mentioned before, those series are all ending at 12 for this iteration. Well, not before on this episode, but when we reviewed Traveler on recent weekly comic spotlight.
Well, and one of the things we talked about between recording episodes is the challenge these sorts of things have, as with any essentially licensed property, which is technically what these are. They've got to kick out a little bit to Stan Lee. They got to kick out a little to the writers. And let's Chris Roberson, Abnett and Lanning, Mark Waid, these are not cheap writers necessarily. I mean, they get paid decently because they write really well. You've got the art teams, you've got the printing costs, you've got the boom overhead. I mean, there are a lot of costs on this that if these were, I mean, like a point you had made to me offline was if these were just creator-owned titles or whatever, they wouldn't have some of those additional financial hurdles to overcome.
Yeah, I mean, pure speculation on our part, but one would imagine that if I'm writing something that I own lock, stock, and barrel, you know, if I'm Mark Waid, I'm willing to do it for less upfront money than if I'm doing something that's owned by somebody else, where what I'm going to get on it is what I'm getting in my page rates.
Well, the fact that Stan Lee's POW Entertainment is on the inside front cover of Traveler number 9, I mean, that doesn't come just for free. There's, a contractual agreement there that means that POW Entertainment's getting something out of the deal other than just their little logo there. So, that's one of those where, you know, I think it's selling decently for them. It's certainly, obviously, with this being at 300, the bottom of what's showing up on the list of 300 for Boom this month. But it goes back to one of the comments you were making earlier about, you know, we can't tell what's profitable, what's not, because there's so many variables. Page rates, if there are licensing costs, how much these guys are paying for printing, how much they're getting from the retailers, all that kind of a thing. And that's why I talk about if the sales are up or down, not if the profitability is up or down. Because really, it could be that there would be other factors that would cause a title in this area to continue on forever. A good example, smack dab in the middle of this crowd, is Usagi Yojimbo at rank 295 there with 4,778 units. That's down about 0.5% or whatever. But again, creator-owned, it's through Dark Horse. Stan Sakai is going to do this title probably forever.
Again, yeah, and if he's not doing it through Dark Horse, he'll do it through somebody else.
Yep.
You know, he's in it for the long game. I mean, he's telling his story, and he's got his, you
he's
know,
got
trades,
his trades
that he puts
hard
out.
Covers, exactly.
And, you know, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, he's obviously making a living doing it. He's been doing it for 20-some-odd years, you know, and nicest guy you could ever meet. And it's a great book. I just wish more people would have the opportunity to try something like this out.
Yeah. I think it's something that, frankly, all the comic book podcasters out there ought to be taking a look at these lower selling rankings of the list every month. Those are the titles they should be, you know, finding the creators to interview, talking about on their podcasts, whatever. These are the ones that really, I think, need to be spotlighted a little bit more than the, okay, let's talk about every issue of every Flashpoint thing or every issue of this other big event or whatever. Because some of these creators that are down in these rankings today, 5-10 years from now, are going to be writing those events or whatever. I mean, where do you think a lot of today's big names came from?
Well,
they
came from the indie. Where did Remender and Hickman and all these Marvel guys? Marvel's done a lot better job at using these creator-owned titles as a farm system for their top architects. You know, look at their architects. Which one of their architects didn't come from indie comics? Bendis did.
Yeah,
you have to look a little farther back, but you know, boy, he, and even before Powers, I mean, he was doing Jinx and Goldfish and, you know, Torso and a lot of really, you know, what would be considered, you know, if you put that out today and it didn't have Brian Michael Bendis, you could take that same book and put it out. It's like a fringe indie book. It was really good. It would have been selling, and I'm sure it did back then, way down here. But that doesn't mean that it's not a great story, and it doesn't mean that, you know, he didn't do great things. And the same thing with Remender, and the same thing with Hickman, and, you know, all these guys, you know, they start somewhere. And, boy, there's a lot of really great stuff that's coming out.
Well, yeah, I mean, just like, you know, professional sports teams are sending recruiters to college games and stuff to go find who's the up-and-coming athlete and stuff, the editors and stuff over at DC, Marvel, and Dark Horse Image, etc., are looking towards these other publishers, these guys doing the solo stuff to see, okay, and Hollywood's doing the same thing. Who are these up-and-comers who can snatch them up first and get them entrenched where they're at, you know? That's worked really well for a lot of people. So, and the bottom line is, while we're looking at the sales figures here, this is not the be-all, end-all determination of what is quote-unquote successful by any stretch of the imagination. This is just how things are selling, what state is the sales part of the industry in. Some of these properties are much, much healthier in other venues for other reasons, be it the mass market sales, which I think, with Borders going away, definitely takes a chunk out of. But again, some of these are licensed properties that where they're doing on the TV shows, the animated, that's where a lot of their income is coming from. Let's see. Price point-wise, 56% of the list, a little over 169 items, were at that $299 price. 100 items were at the 33%, or the 33% of the things with 100 items were at the $399. And really, I mean, that right there accounts for, 269 of the items. It's not that hard to do the math, but yes, I did need Excel to do it to me. Add the 16 items at $350, and that accounts for 285 of the items. The others were scattered at 2 for a dollar, 2 at $250. 8 at $4.99, 2 at $5.99, 1 at $7.99. Now, out of those 299 ones, let me filter the list. I want to see how many of those are DC. So, again, we've got the 169. Out of those, DC accounted for 83. So all the ones other than that accounted for 86. So DC was about half of those. Marvel was only 50 of them, but that's actually a decent number. So I think, you know, DC's obviously still leading the pack with that 299. Marvel is begrudgingly accepting it in a couple of cases. Again, that's an expensive move for publishers, particularly if they had to roll back the prices, as was the case with DC.
Right.
So, but to me, that shows it's not just business as usual, and they're actually trying to grow the industry, or at least, you know, prevent it from shrinking too far. And I think that's a valid concern. I really think they're taking a huge risk with this relaunch, and I hope it pans out for them. They've got a lot riding on that. Now, one of the latest books to come out in June was, of course, Ultimate Comics X number 5. It was 38 weeks late. We had Invincible number 80 shows up as 21 weeks late, although it was only how many issues since the only 5 weeks since the previous issue. That goes towards the almost perennially late sometimes with Kirkman titles, which he's just overtaxed. He's doing too much. Witchblade 145 was 20 weeks late. We had a few others that were kind of late. A couple that were a couple of weeks early. That Starborn number 7 at the bottom, 3 weeks early. Traveler was a week early. Soldier Zero was 2 weeks early. So, and some of these guys can not only get the books out on time, they can actually, you know, exceed expectations.
Yeah, and as you'll hear on one of the interviews that are coming up on the interviews episode for the month, when I talk to Tim Seeley, who's taking over Witchblade, one of the things, you know, it's like, you know, a lot of those Top Cow books, Witchblade included, have been plagued by lateness. And, you know, he's got 4 scripts done already. The artist on it has got, you know, the first issue or two completely done already, and they're just soliciting 151. And he said, you know, one of the key things that was discussed when they hired him and the new artist was getting the title back on track and making sure that it comes out on time, because that is a huge factor in keeping momentum on these stories. You know, you don't want someone to just hack something out just to have it be on time, but at the same time, you know, when you have these multiple month delays in things coming out, it really kills momentum for titles. And I think it's demonstrated to show that it hurts sales, right?
Oh, totally, totally. I mean, the 7.71% drop on that Ultimate Comics X number 5, certainly not all of that is the delay, but I think that's a major factor. When it should have come out at the beginning of October, it comes out at the end of June. You know, it's like that kills story momentum.
And that one benefited, in my opinion, from it's like the only book out there that Art Adams is doing the art for on the inside. And there are a lot of Art Adams fans, myself included. It's like, well, I don't care how late it is, I'll buy it just to look at the Art Adams art. You know, whereas if it was like Joe Blow drawing that, I don't think that would have done nearly as well.
I think that's true. I mean, I don't want to say that because it's late, it will sell less as a rule. I mean, generally that'll happen, but there have been others where things have been egregiously late and sold as well or better than that previous issue because it's something that's still highly anticipated. It's got a great creative team, whatever. If it's good enough, people will wait. But I really hate this. Well, do you want it good or do you want it on time? I want both. And the reason I want both is because the creators, the publishers are setting that expected ship date when they solicit. They are setting the bar they themselves have to meet. So for it to be on time, I'm judging it against what they said on time meant. So right. It's not like some third party is imposing some arbitrary deadline on them.
Let's look at it this way. You know, it's like, look at some of these artists who people love and respect as some of the greatest artists of all time. Look at Jack Kirby. You know, a lot of people love Jack Kirby. How many books did that guy put out a month? Gene Colan, one of my personal favorite artists of all time, recently passed away. Immensely talented man. He, when I started reading comics, he was putting out 3 comic books a month. He was doing the art on Captain America, Daredevil, and Iron Man.
But even if those were only 17 pages, the fact he's doing 3 of those a month would still equate to about 2 of today's issues.
Right. And, you know, so it's like when you got these guys that are doing 1 issue a month, you know, it's not a matter of do you want it good or do you want it on time. It is possible to do good work on time.
Well, and some to do 2 books a month. I think who was the one who was on JSA for a while? I think it was Leonard Kirk, who was concurrently doing a second title at the same time. I mean, he seemed to be one of those that was just able to great consistent stuff. I loved his art, and just not only on time, but have time for another book. Now, the other one may not have been every month or whatever, but you know what I mean. It was he would do it periodically or something. I'm thinking though he was able to do 2 concurrently. And I could be wrong on which artist it was, but there are some even today that have that kind of quality, that kind of you know, throughput on their art board that is just staggering. So when I see something that I think is just brilliant, but it's like, am I ever going to see that second issue? I'm going to pick on Nate Simpson here. I think he's a good case in point. Brilliant first issue, great art on Non-Player number 1. It's been optioned for a movie, I believe.
Yep.
So successful for him. That does kind of validate to a degree, having gotten the stake in the ground on that intellectual property and stuff. It's been 6, maybe 7 solicitation cycles since. No sign of that second issue. So as a comic book goes, as much as I love that first issue, it's really hampering the series for me. Because I'm wondering when, if ever, I'm going to get the second issue. And now, the question that raises for me as a cynical comic reader is, well, how much of the story we're going to get is going to be what he really wanted to tell versus what he has been influenced by Hollywood to tell in order to do a good movie?
Well, I'm not worried about that because movies and comics are completely different things. I mean, they're going to option an idea and they're going to do something that's whatever it is that they want to do. And the comic, there's really no need for it to be particularly the same as the movie. And if you look at, like, for instance, the Surrogates comic book series and the Surrogates movie with Bruce Willis, I mean,
the difference,
you know,
is
they're different things.
The Surrogates, the series was completed before the movie.
Yeah, but
the fact that it's taking 6 months between issues, we have no idea when he's going to get that final issue of this story arc done compared to how quickly the movie may, or it may not even happen, but you know what I mean? And I'm not saying it will influence the comic book story. I'm saying the question of if it could is now raised.
I just don't think there's any reason for it to do it. I don't think Hollywood would have any reason to ask for it. He'd have no reason to do it. So that's not a concern for me.
Well, it may not be for you.
You're welcome to have whatever concerns you want.
I'm just saying he's obviously in discussions with Hollywood. That's going to influence his thinking to some degree. It may not consciously change the story, but it could. And this is one where if he'd been getting it out on a monthly basis, he'd have told that first story arc before it's been optioned or whatever. It's in the can. It couldn't have influenced the story he's telling. That's all I'm saying. Now, and I'm not even saying if it does influence that it would be a negative. But it's one of those where, going back to our original point of the story momentum mattering and getting things out on a timely basis, that really matters. I mean, some of these things that DC is relaunching with new number ones, really the new number one's going to be the old number one because it took them that long to get Batwoman out. You know, they'll have gotten hopefully through that first arc of the Batman Dark Knight series by Finch before they have to relaunch it at number one for the second arc for it. You know, it's going to be interesting going forward to see how DC in particular does with, you know, renumbering things and relaunching things, you know, how long their titles last going forward. I mean, they've already got Volume 2 of that Batman Odyssey coming out to finish off the first volume, which I guess they kind of considered almost aborted after, what, 6 issues?
That's one I'm definitely not jumping on the relaunch of.
Well, again, the relaunch is just the continuation of it.
I know,
it's kind of silly.
That series was...
Yeah. So, all right, like I said earlier, we're a little late doing this just because of the time commitments I've had because of Comic-Con and when the numbers came out and stuff and when some of the additional data I needed came out. The data is already starting to trickle out for July. They've released, I believe, the top 10. So as soon as I can get that, you know, full list of 300 and get that crunched, we'll probably come back in about 2 weeks with the July stuff and then hopefully kind of get back on track. But this is just one of those times a year where, because of Comic-Con, I just get behind on everything. The podcasting we're doing quite a bit of. I've got a short box full of comics to go read at some point. Plus all these wonderful interviews and stuff we've got. Just getting all those put in place and getting those done. So, fun stuff. Anything else? Does that do it?
Does it for me.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you're in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. If you're a resident of some other space-time continuum, please limit any actions you may take to that alternate reality. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. Diamond Order Index only goes to 2 decimal places, and therefore there's a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. For months in which no issue of Batman or Detective shipped, Batman: The Battle for the Cowl was used instead. The title used as the key title is irrelevant. If you do not understand why or do not believe this, please consider taking a refresher course on basic algebra. Math is fun, but only if you understand it. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Sell-through information is not currently available, and we limit our reporting to the available information. If, however, you enjoy fiction, please listen to this preview spotlight for our recommendations of upcoming comic books. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications that at least one retailer may have excessive amounts of empty shelf space with dust that needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold to Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month in question. The list of the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to the retailers for the month in question. More than 300 graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of the top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 100, 50, 25, or as few as 10 items on the list. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as we know, has not been invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic book, graphic novel, or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 300 graphic novels and collected edition lists are included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. For some strange reason, Diamond doesn't report on sales to competing distributors. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any item sold outside of Diamond's comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. We limit this report to the available data. If more data becomes available, we'd be happy to include it. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for. No amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is inapplicable in the alternate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there. I have neither the time nor the interest in engaging in pointless debates in this hypothetical reality. There are no guarantees of accuracy, reliability, completeness, or timeliness of any of the information given in the course of this discussion. We are human, and sometimes we make mistakes. We appreciate your understanding in this area. Any statements that may contain projections or other predictions about future events should be viewed as opinions that are subject to change as new information becomes available. Actual events may unfold in unexpected ways. As Doc Brown once said, the future is what you make of it. If any statements are contradicted or contested, the participants of the discussion may disavow any knowledge of those statements.